Thank you for joining us on After Dark with Rob and Andrew here on America Out Loud Talk Radio. It's been an action-packed year on America Out Loud, which is available on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcast, or Pandora. And don't miss anything over at the website, AmericaOutLoud.com, which is loaded with articles and countless hours of podcasts like Voice of a Nation, Ladies of Liberty, Talking While Married, and so many other great shows over at America Out Loud. And don't forget After Dark with Robin Andrew. Tonight, we're going to take the night off from politics and Joe Biden, and we're going to be talking all things space. We will be joined by professor and PhD in astrophysics, Joshua Spodek, who once worked with NASA to build a satellite. Recently, billionaire Jeff Bezos was part of the first civilian flight to space. We all remember President Trump loved space himself and even formed the new military branch called Space Force. So lots is going on in the space front, and we are excited tonight to keep you guys updated and talk about space with Joshua Spodek. But first off, how are you doing tonight, Rob?
I'm doing great, thank you. I'm glad to have our listeners here with us tonight. Hope they enjoy this episode, an episode hopefully free of politics. I will say one thing related to politics is that when Trump started or created Space Force, a lot of people laughed at him, especially Jen Psaki. They gave a little chuckle, they teased him, trolled him on Facebook. And now it seems to be the latest thing that's out there. So I'm glad to have Josh on to talk to us about space, all things space, and you know what he has done in relationship to it. When I think of space, I think of Star Trek, the show back in the 60s. I used to love to watch it, and I always imagined, you know, what would it be like living in outer space? And did we actually land on the moon when we said that we landed on the moon, or did we land on something else, some other planet? But another question comes to mind is that did Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson, did they do something that was fantastic or phenomenal? I mean, they left Earth like 50 miles from Earth, and I'm sure that the site, what they were looking at was fantastic. But is it something that we should all be like, wow, this is great, this is unbelievable? Or was landing on the moon, so we say, was that a bigger deal? Maybe they were all big. I don't know. But it does beg the question, at least for me, as to all the excitement with them leaving planet Earth and going to the outer ends or outside of Earth. And now, will that become a trend with people going to outer space? Who would want to do it? And the cost, I'm sure that the cost will eventually go down. I was just shocked that that 18-year-old kid, his dad, I think is a venture capitalist, put up $28 million. Like, man, that's a lot of money for him to go to outer space. I'm sure he'll, for him, it's like very exciting and he'll always talk about it. But it is something to think about. Outer space. What about yourself, Andrew? Have you ever thought about going to outer space?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Especially when I was a kid, as you said, I'm a big sci-fi fan. My show is Stargate SG-1. I'm a huge fan of the old movie with Kurt Russell, of course, is very good. Also, I'm a big Star Wars fan. So I've always been highly interested in space and sci-fi in general. I'm really looking forward to the show tonight, talking about something different and getting a good education on what is currently going on with Josh Spodek.
And before we bring on Josh, do you believe that there's life on other planets?
Oh, absolutely. I like to believe stuff like that. So I'm easily influenced and inclined to believe that there is life on other planets.
So do you think the UFOs are creatures that are coming in trying to visit us or to look at what we're doing?
Quite possibly. I'm not for sure on UFOs. I definitely think it is something, whether it be a foreign government or something from outer space. But I think at some point we've definitely had visits from UFOs. I even like some of like the Great Pyramid conspiracies over in Egypt and things like that. So yeah, I've always had fun reading on the space conspiracies even.
Right. And another thing that comes to mind, I always wonder, like, what do the people, what are they? What do they look like? I mean, you see Star Trek and you see all these other shows and they, you know, when you see the creatures, they have like 12 heads, 12 eyes, and they're more attractive. And they look at we mirror humans and they say, ugh, they're ugly. So I always wonder, like, what do they look like if it does exist? And I'm sure some of you are probably one scratching your head saying, what the heck are they talking about? Well, again, it's something different. We decided to go with something completely different other than politics. We wanted to talk about space, since space seems to be the flavor of the month right now, with Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson going to outer space. So without further ado, let's bring on Josh Spodek. He'll give us his background and talk to us about space. Josh, how is it going?
Very good. And I have to say, it was listening without talking just now was like torture, because you guys said so many things I wanted to jump in on. And one of the top ones was that I haven't really, you know, for decades now, people would say, they'd introduce me and they'd say, so if you ever need something really hard done, Josh is a rocket scientist. So he could talk about, he can do these things. Although formally I didn't work on the rockets. I worked on a satellite that was launched by rocket, a couple of them. And I don't always think so much about how, when I was a kid, how much I wanted to be an astronaut. My birthday is July 20th, and that's when Neil Armstrong first set foot on the moon. So I was born a couple of years later. But it's just coincidence, but I've always felt an affinity because of that. I don't know. I think a lot of little boys really like the idea of going into space is a big deal. And I was born in a time when it's hard to imagine going back to a time when people didn't think, like, they couldn't imagine, like, oh, that would be impossible to make it to the moon. And I've just always lived in a world where it was possible. And I would love to get that experience. It's something I haven't thought of in a long time. I mean, now I'm a little old to start training, although I guess some old people have gone up now. But yeah, thank you for your mind on that.
It sounds like if you have $500,000 to spare, you might be able to go in the next few years if Bezos and Elon Musk are successful.
Something else to think about when you say that you're too old, Josh, think of the lady who did go up. I think she was in her 80s and she had always wanted to go up, but she was prohibited from going up because she was a female. Now, 2021, we've progressed beyond that. So just to know that she was able to go up, I was happy for her having wanted to do it all those years. And then finally, the opportunity presented itself. So Josh, you never know.
I'm not holding my breath, but I hope I get the chance. I mean, I would really like to go. And so I'm going to switch tacks a bit to talk about, I mean, what I worked on was a satellite that was an X-ray observational satellite. So X-rays are produced in the universe, but they don't penetrate the Earth's atmosphere. So we had no idea. Well, we didn't even know X-rays existed before mid 20th century, early 20th century, with people who were discovering radioactivity. We didn't know that stuff out in space did until we had rockets. So it wasn't until World War II that we even conceived of stuff being out there. I mean, there's some coming from the sun that we could see, but very little would make it through the atmosphere. And then suddenly we get up into space and there's a lot of it. And the first generation of satellites that went up looked out and didn't see, they saw some, they were surprised to find, oh, there's X-rays out there. And then the next generation, the one before mine, went out and looked and said, oh, there's actual point sources. Like, it's coming from specific places. And my generation of satellites could really look at things and find out what is specifically going on there. It had high resolution in space and in energy. And there was actually a NASA satellite that went up at the same time as a European Space Agency satellite that went up with a Japan satellite. And they were designed to complement each other. It was, you know, I was just thinking about when you guys talked about what we were going to talk about tonight, I thought of the days back when, you know, when you build a satellite that, we built a satellite that went into high Earth orbit, meaning the shuttle can't reach it. Meaning once it's up, there is no accessing it again. So you have to build something that has to operate in space. So you can never fix it if it's broken. There's no oxygen. Some things are in your favor. It's not like the wind is going to erode it, but also there's radiation. It's a vacuum. It's incredibly difficult to work with, and you can't like diagnose things. So you have to build it perfectly. You have to get it right the first time. And here's an interesting thing. The parts that I worked on were these optics, and stop me if I'm getting into too much science here, if it sounds too technical, but some people dig the details. But if a piece of dust got on it, we couldn't get the piece of dust off, because if we tried to blow it off, that would risk scratching the surface. So we had to work in a clean room, and I had to wear like a net over my hair. And my advisor had a big beard, so he had to go in and put a net over his beard as well. And actually, oh man, I'm going to tell you guys something that I used to joke about this, that I always wanted to write my name on one of the things, because once it was written, even if they got really mad at me and said, you're not supposed to do that, they couldn't do anything about it. They'd still have to put it up there. And that way, if the aliens came and saw, they'd see who to come to. That would be me, because my name was on the thing. But I never did that.
Josh, let's take a step back. And you are a PhD in astrophysics. What about space when you were younger? Piqued your interest? And when did you figure out that things came easier for you than most in regards to space, where you could become such an expert?
Well, it wasn't so much that when things became easy for me, or when I could tell that I liked math and science. It was more the opposite. People could tell early, and I tried to hide it because I was a nerd and I would get picked on. And it wasn't until college and I started really being my own person that I said, you know what? I love this stuff and I want to do it even if it's not popular. And I guess as we get older, we can, and you start to own things more, then I could really just love it. And if people didn't like it, that's their business. But when I was younger, I was pretty good at it. And yeah, I tried to hide it. I'm not so glad about that. I wish I'd been more strong about that earlier. And the idea of wanting to be up there, the adventure of it, that's as early as I can remember. I mean, it was astronauts wanting to be an astronaut, wanting to find dinosaur bones. As best I can tell, it's as early as I can remember. The idea of, you know, you see, like to be in a place where there's lower gravity, or to have to be in a place with zero gravity in between, to be in orbit. You know, you just got me thinking of, there was Apollo 13, but there's another movie. October Sky was about someone building rockets. And I haven't thought about it in a while, but you're asking me, Andrew, made me think about it.
Why did you build the satellite?
So I went into graduate school for physics. For me, physics, a lot of people associate physics with like wearing lab coats and doing experiments with big things in like the Large Hadronic Collider. And I did do a stint in high energy particle physics, which was working at Fermilab and what later the LHC before it was the LHC. The reason I switched into this was partly because my advisor had, the experiment was a great experiment. He wasn't a part of it at the beginning, but he had an idea for what's called the spectrometer, the device that measures the spectrum. But his design was so much better than the previous design that they said, we have to use this. We have to switch. He knows it better than anyone. So he has to do it. So he was very, very well connected. The other people working on the experiment were, I liked the other people on the experiment. And, you know, I ended up starting a company and left academia to go into business on my own. But the other people in the experiment, let's see if I can remember. One went to NASA, one went to Harvard, one went to, I think, to either Caltech or Stanford. A couple stayed at Columbia. So it was a very, very successful experiment. And it's rare that you get a chance to see, if you help build a satellite, you get the data. Technically, the data is the public because it's paid for by governments. But we get a year of the data first. So, and I was joining the experiment. It takes about 10, 12 years to build a satellite. So I was coming in about halfway through, maybe two-thirds of the way through. So that meant I could work on it for a bit and then get the data and I would publish right away. So it was a very, very good opportunity to get new data that other people hadn't seen, publish on my, you know, get my name out there. It was hard not to go for that experiment.
Josh, we see so much happening in space right now. As we mentioned at the top of the broadcast, we talked about Jeff Bezos going up to space, and then we see Elon Musk in SpaceX. First off, Jeff Bezos, I guess he was a surprise because everyone expected Elon Musk to do this before him. What were your thoughts on that mission recently with Jeff Bezos going up to space?
Well, I'm a bit mixed because I like the idea of going up into space, but I think manned space exploration, I believe we can do a lot more for the same amount of money with robots and unmanned stuff. So if it's pure science, I'm a big fan of pure science and finding out more about the universe. I just love what we find. And the question you asked earlier, is there life out there? It's this crazy thing that all we know says that the probability is very high. It seems And yet we see no sign of it that we can, and no intelligible sign of it. So that's one of the big, big mysteries that not only is it a question in astronomy and astrophysics, but it's biology and it's everything. I mean, and so I'm a big fan of learning more about the universe and getting above the atmosphere in order to find that out. Space tourism is a, I'm very mixed on that and tending toward it's, I feel like it's a bit of, what's the word, indulgence? Like it seems like it would be very cool to do, but I'd rather put those resources into learning about the universe. That said, I don't know. I'm not going to stop them. It's, you know, it's a free country, or I guess it's also a legal issue of who has rights to go up into space and things like that. I think that I certainly read a lot of things where people are like, hey, these guys look like they're showing off and just indulging themselves. I tend to agree with that. So I feel kind of funny because of how much I love space, how much I've done in devoting myself to learning about things that are out there, but not being so big on this. And I hope that's not, I hope I don't sound like a downer, but I think there's other ways to get thrills that aren't quite so, I mean, to me, there's a lot of, how do I put it? We're putting a lot of stuff in space that is like turning into kind of junk. There's like, we're not keeping it so pure and clean. And we act as if it's really big because the universe is really big, but the amount of space right outside of orbit is not so great. And I think we haven't really looked too far ahead to see how we can use this space, this resource most wisely.
Yeah. And then Elon Musk, I know you said you're not a big fan of humans going up to space just for thrills, but Elon Musk and SpaceX have been doing a lot of other things, shooting rockets up into space, and now they even have a close relationship with NASA. Have you ever gotten the opportunity to meet Elon Musk, and what are your thoughts on what you've seen from SpaceX so far? Have you been impressed?
Haven't met him yet. I look forward to it happening at some point. I'm sure we'd get along. He also has as I think you probably know, he's a degree in physics, I think from Penn. And actually, come to think of it, I spent a year and a half at Penn too. So we could talk about David Rittenhouse Labs and the places we probably spent time to get, same places we were. And I think that there's probably a pretty good chance that for space work to be done, NASA did a great job. And I expect NASA will continue to do great jobs on, I mean, we got people to the moon. And I do expect that moving some things over to the private sector will probably make things faster and cheaper. Not all. I think some things probably the government is still going to be better at. I think that he brings, you know, he's a, I don't know how to put it. He's like a kind of cowboy about it. He's like, I think he brings an element of fun to it that I think is, what's the word? Intriguing and infectious. So there's this heightened pursuit. And I think that the public is engaging in it in a way that we haven't for a while. I think that's exciting.
Yeah, he's almost like a celebrity. He does bring a lot of attention to SpaceX and his company Tesla, that's for sure. He was even the host on Saturday Night Live earlier this year. I've always liked Elon Musk, and I really like the things that he is doing. So I look forward to seeing what SpaceX is doing in the future. As for NASA, Josh, have you heard anything on what their plans are right now? Do you think NASA will ever focus on putting a man back on the moon? Or are we just going to go straight to maybe someone landing on Mars? How far away could we possibly be from some of those things?
These are very big open questions. It's tough to say, especially because a moonshot is, I mean, despite having done it multiple times before, it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. And, you know, there's a lot of risks that were taken the first time that I think if we were to do it again, we wouldn't take some of the risks. But if you want to make it up, sometimes you have to do things.
A lot of people ask that. Why has it been so long since we have put someone on the moon? Now, with modern day technology, you talk about the risk. Would it not be safer now than perhaps it was 40, 50 years ago to send someone up on the moon? And would there not be a lot more that we could discover now?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what we would want to discover. I mean, there's not that much going on the moon. I think we found out mostly what it's made of. We found out that there's not life there. I don't think there's much that we could do there in terms of terraforming. There's no atmosphere. So I'm not sure what at the time, certainly there's a space race and there was we wanted to beat the Russians. And that was a very big motivator. But now that we've done it, I'm not sure what the advantage would be of getting there. If we want to set up a colony there, or if we want to set up a colony on Mars or any place, I mean, Jupiter's moons could be another place, then, you know, we tried to put, what was it called? In Arizona, there was the name escapes me for a second, but we tried to set up a controlled closed system there, and it didn't work. We weren't able to do that. It would be interesting, I think, an interesting first step, or not first step, but middle step for getting a colony onto Mars or the moon or any place or in orbit would be to get a colony on Earth in a place where it's difficult, under the ocean, Antarctica, the top of a high mountain. Could we get people living there for a long period of time? Could we have an undersea colony? An undersea colony has certain challenges that we wouldn't face on Mars in terms of like salt water is very, very difficult to work with. On the other hand, it's much, much easier than Mars because a person to help is just, you know, we could have direct communication very fast and someone could just swim down or not swim, but, you know, we could take a submarine down very quickly to get there and help them if there was a problem. Much, much easier than to have a colony on Mars. But I don't think we can do it on Earth either. I mean, Antarctica, to have people there, a colony there, or colony underwater, a colony on maybe not Everest, but, you know, really tall mountain. That would be something interesting to do. And I don't think we have it done yet. I don't think we could do that. Or even just floating in the ocean for a long time. So to get colonies in other places, I think it's much harder than people think. And you know, one of the reasons people have for promoting it is something that it's the odds of at some point, another asteroid hitting the planet, something like that, what wiped out the dinosaurs, could happen to us. I mean, it's certainly in the time that the sun will be providing enough energy for life on Earth to happen, something is going to hit the Earth almost certainly at some point. Now, that could be on the order of tens of millions of years from now. It's probably not going to happen. I think NASA has mapped out with a very high probability, we can say that there's nothing's going to hit us in the next several decades, maybe centuries. But at some point, we do want to get off somehow off of here. To me, the best way to do that is not necessarily to try to race up there now. We know that we can get to the moon. We know we can get something to Mars. Do we need in the next decade, century, to get to Mars to save the species? I don't think necessarily save the species in the next century, but at some point, yes. But I think the most effective way to do that would be not to try to race there and try to do it very fast, but to do it methodically and really build up a solid foundation of how to do it. I don't think that's what we're doing now. So I'm a big fan of figuring out how to get to other planets at some point, but I see that as something that happens over a longer period of time than decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And this seems to be like the tough thing about space for people. Even you look back at when I was a kid, people were curious when we were going to land on Mars, if we were going to find life on Mars. But with some of this stuff, it takes so long to send satellites up there to even reach Mars. People can lose interest rather fast. I think the good thing about sending people up to the moon, or maybe this Jeff Bezos going up and sending civilians up to space, is maybe it will get people interested and curious about space once again, because people need something to be excited about. And sometimes these research developments can take quite a few years before they develop.
The curiosity about nature in general, I think it's been waning in the United States. We haven't had science education as strong in recent years or even decades as we had in the past. Certainly the space race drove up interest in science, just pure education. And that said, space is not the only place to be curious about. I was talking to a friend about nature in general. And he said, you know, Josh, what about space? Like, shouldn't we go out and like discover all these things? And I also said to him, you know, look out your window. I said, yeah. And I said, are there any trees out there? And he goes, yeah. And I go, do you know how many species of trees there are? Do you know what kind of birds interact with those trees? What kind of bugs live on them? Do they produce fruit? And he said, you know, he looked at me, we're on Zoom, and he's like, I have no idea. And there's a lot of curiosity about nature that I think it's space is one big one, but also to me, just, I mean, even gardening is to me exploring nature and learning about it. And you can learn about biodiversity and how different plants interact with different animals and how they taste. And to me, that's very interesting as well. So space is one area of interest. I'm not a biologist or a chemist, but I think these are other areas of great interest. You know, health. There's a lot of big science in health. And there's also, I think some of the biggest advances came from things like washing hands and discoveries of things that weren't like really big science things. So I also want to make sure that when I think of my nieces and nephews learning science, also just doing stuff with your hands and picking up a shell at the beach and trying to figure out where it came from. And I don't think we're as curious. Maybe I'm being jaded, but I feel like there's also a lot of curiosity in other areas that we haven't been as up on as we have been in the past. And I think we would benefit from that.
We are here with Joshua Spodek, PhD in astrophysics, and we are talking space tonight on After Dark with Rob and Andrew. Thank you so much, Josh, for that information. In the first half, we are here with PhD in astrophysics, Joshua Spodek, and you are listening to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud, which is available on iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Check out the articles over at AmericaOutLoud.com, and we will be back with more space talk with PhD in astrophysics, Josh Spodek.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
AmericaOutLoud.com. Simply put, we're patriots who believe in Ronald Reagan's vision of a shining city on a hill. From sea to shining sea, you can listen in on iHeartRadio. Our free apps are on Apple, Android, or Alexa, or our world-class media player. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
So we are back after dark with Rob and Andrew, and our guest tonight is Joshua Spodek, and we are talking about space, the final frontier, as we used to hear on our Star Trek, the place where no man has gone before, seeking out new civilizations to boldly go where no one has gone before. I think that's what it is. I might have gotten it wrong, but being that as it may, space. I'm going to bring Josh back on because I want Josh to explain to all of our viewers just exactly what an astrophysics is. What does he do and what does it take to become one? Josh, how are you?
Very good.
Okay, Josh, so if you could just give us just again, I know we spoke about it at the beginning of the show, but talk to us again about that profession and what it does exactly, of what a person does with that type of degree.
Sure. So my degree is a PhD in physics, and my advisor was jointly in the physics department and the astronomy department. So there's astrophysics, which is the overlap between physics and astronomy. Astronomy is looking out at this, and astronomy goes back as far as pre-recorded history, because people looked up at the stars and they see these patterns. You know, the stars, it certainly, before people had a sense of the Earth being round, it certainly seems like it's the center of the universe. The stars go around it, the moon goes around it, the sun goes around it. That's what it looks like. And it certainly looks like the Earth is flat. Some people saw that the shadows in one place were different than the shadows of another place, and that implied that the Earth was round. So that was a big discovery that had to be rediscovered a couple of times in history. And actually, it's very interesting. If you think of why it looks like the stars go around the Earth, is for a different reason than why it looks like the moon goes around the Earth, which is for a different reason than why it looks like the sun going around the Earth. One is because the Earth is going around the sun. The other is, well, another is because the Earth is spinning on an axis. The other is because, anyway, there's lots of different things going on. So this goes back thousands, tens of thousands of years, the study of astronomy, what's out there and why do things move the way that they do. Now, physics absent astronomy is things like what happens if you spin a top, how is its behavior going to move? Now it's more like looking into atoms and figuring out what things are made out of. The way that they overlap is that if, say, you look out into space and you see, well, one application that most people know would be gravity. You know, Newton saw an apple falling and he saw there was a certain behavior and he could predict how gravity worked with something on the Earth, but also how the moon would behave going around the Earth. And so can we describe why things are the way they are out there using the same physics that we use to describe things here? Can we understand what something is just from looking at it from very far away? So some of the early stuff would be figuring out orbits. That would be something on the border between astronomy and astrophysics. Why do the different planets have different periods going around the sun based on the distance and the mass and things like that? And then you might get into something very much more astrophysics, might be very slight differences. People might know that the Mercury, very closer to the sun than us, its orbit is not exactly an ellipse as we predicted. It was very slightly different. For a long time, people couldn't figure out. So now, is it our measurements are off? Is it that the theory is off? If the theory is off and it explains everything except Mercury, how can that be? As it turns out, Einstein's general theory of relativity explained it, and he didn't intend to explain that. He came out from a totally different area. So taking physics and applying it to what's going on out there. For what I did, before the generation of satellites that I had, some satellites went up and they could see over there, there's some X-rays coming from something. And we'd look at it and we'd say, what could be causing the pattern of X-rays that we see? We could look at it also in the optical band and see, okay, there's a supernova event there. So sometime a while ago, before us, maybe a supernova went off and there's expanding gas into space. And we know something about it from having better the astronomy of it. We can tell what's going on there. How can we explain in detail why we see the particular pattern in X-rays that we do? That takes physics. We have to reconstruct and make up ideas and say, if it was this, we'd get this type of observation. If it was that, it would be that type of observation. And so we're trying to figure out what's the thing that we're looking at made of. Astronomy alone doesn't tell you that. Physics, you got to throw some physics in there to figure out that maybe there's a neutron star at the center and the neutron star is shooting out jets of high energy particles that are interacting with the gas that exploded from it. And that might give the particular pattern that we see. If that's so, then if we see that a pattern like that in other places, but it's slightly different, we should be able to predict why it's different in slightly different ways and develop a theory of how supernova remnants work. That's what I worked on with supernova remnants. But there are lots of other things. There could be black holes and accretion disks. And so astrophysics is taking astronomy data and figuring out at a deeper level what's going on. And now, for those of us who are just into astronomy and astrophysics and physics because we're curious, that's just very interesting to us. We're intrigued by it. As it turns out, the technologies that come out of this tend to benefit humans tremendously. learning about it, working with x-rays as I did, it helps to make x-rays using less energy, which when, you know, when we're checking the medical stuff, then they're safer when there's less energy. And it tends to evolve into, you know, people do something in physics or astrophysics, and then they have an idea to take it into commercial applications, into medical applications, into industrial applications. So it's tended overall to pay off economically. Money spent in basic science has tended to return very well.
Now, does any of this have to, or will it come into play, let's say, if we were to decide that we wanted to set up a colony on another planet? We're talking about that in the first segment. Does any of that be beneficial if that were to happen?
Well, everything that we do not involving humans is going to help stuff with humans. I mean, making radiation hard, stuff that can withstand radiation, stuff that can withstand being in space for a long, long time. I mean, it's much easier to get a robot to handle space than a human. And it's much easier. I mean, there's a reason they put up animals first before humans. So, and just testing what's out there is always, with things like satellites, it's going to make it easier when we put up people.
No, that begs the next question as far as putting up people. Because I, and I mentioned this somewhat in the first segment, as far as people going into outer space, wanting to live there, going to the moon, other than the aspect of just doing it out of just curiosity, why would I want to leave planet Earth and live on Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, or what have you? I know that a lot of people say, but what if the Earth becomes too crowded? If there's life on another planet, why would they want us to come there, bringing our germs, our issues to that planet, if we can't make it work here on Earth? If we're going to be overpopulated here, why take it there? And then it goes back to, if there's life on other planets, and if they've been visiting our planet, why are they doing that? Are they after our natural resources? And if that's the case, we better look out. Why would we think that living there is better than living here?
Yeah, I think that first I have to do a quick aside that growing up, there's a show called V, and I don't know if people, I'm 50 years old, so I remember it really well when I was growing up, and it was, and the aliens had come and they were stealing our water. So I can't help but comment. I really like that show when it's on, the miniseries. But I said one of the things that I think makes a reason and that makes sense to get off into space is in case some natural disaster comes here, a satellite, an asteroid, then we, if we end here, then we're over. If this is the only place we are. But there's another reason that I think a lot of people look to space and other planets is that if we're messing things up here, then maybe we can do better somewhere else. And this is, I think,
wait, you said that if we're messing up here, we could do better somewhere else. I mean, that's a scary thought. And if there's life on another planet, I'm not sure they will want to invite us there. It's like, wait a minute, you guys trash your own planet Earth, and now you're going to come here and do the same thing. I would be really wary. It's like, I don't know about letting those humans come here.
Well, okay. So life in outer space, there's life and there's intelligent life. So just something that's self-reproducing, and it's kind of hard to define what exactly life is, but the odds of life being roughly as intelligent as us is, that's pretty low. I mean, I could imagine something like bacteria more likely than something like humans. That's also possible that there's stuff out there that's so far intelligent beyond us that, you know, the analogy people talk about is like, if a dog, like dogs can tell that we're alive, but they have no sense as far, I mean, I'm not a dog, so I can't say for sure, but I doubt a dog can tell that we are having conversations and talking, like they don't know. Or even like a worm, like what if we're like a worm to this other intelligence? Maybe there's all sorts of stuff going on out there that's clearly life, and we've just can't see it because it's so far intelligent compared to us that we can't tell what's going on. That's possible, in which case we might be like nothing compared to them. I mean, do we really care as we're walking around what worms are doing? I mean, we're glad that they're doing what they do to make plants, help plants live and so forth. But we're not really like, we don't want to talk to them. We just walk past them. We don't care. So it's possible that that's happening and we're just not seeing it. But also I think, I mean, as regards Mars or some of the planet, the moons of Jupiter, as far as I can, it doesn't seem like there's, I mean, there's very, very low chance of there being life there and very, 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 I mean, unthinkably low chances of there being intelligent life somehow hidden. So if we get to Mars, I don't think we're really going to be displacing. I mean, we might bring germs with us that might, who knows what could happen. And it's possible that there are germs that we haven't found yet there. And we might bring our own germs and mess up the ones that were there. And there might be, it's possible that there's life there that formed totally independent of ours. And we could learn tremendous things about it. And what if we brought bacteria there and it messed up that stuff and we would never find out, or it would be what we found out. If we found something out, it wouldn't be as much as we could. So quarantining makes a lot of sense. Now we're getting to stuff beyond what I really know too much about.
Right. But then you look at what happened with here in the United States, America in itself, when people came here and colonized, or say they discovered America, and look at the germs that were brought over. So I'm always, I always think about that, that if we do go in outer space and if we're able to colonize or set up shop or whatnot, what would we bring there that could possibly destroy whatever life is there? Now, Josh, you wrote a piece not too long ago and you were doing a comparison or whatnot, but talk to us about the piece that we were talking about offline.
So it's a piece that you've read, but it hasn't yet been published. So I'm working on a book on sustainability, and I address how a lot of people view Mars, getting to Mars might be an escape if the Earth isn't doing so well, if we're lowering Earth's ability to sustain life, which seems to be the case. It seems like it's degrading. It's our ability to sustain the number of people it could sustain now and coming up seems to be lower than before with sea level rise and things like that. So I did this part that is, some people really like it. So I talk about how, I'm going to give a little context and I'll read a passage from the book probably to come out in 2022. So sorry to give everyone a teaser that you have to wait a bit for, but I talked about how if people live, I was talking about how people live, one of the comparisons I had was people living in Hawaii after the Polynesians discovered it, but stopped trading with it. And before Captain Cook discovered it for Europeans, there's a period of a couple hundred years in between. And so I said, consider the Hawaiians living sustainably before Captain Cook, because they lived sustainably. The population had reached a stable level. And so I'm going to read now from it, and I hope I gave enough context for it to make sense. So the islands are volcanic. Imagine a new undersea volcano erupting, creating a new nearby island big enough to support a human population. It would start off lifeless, but the Hawaiians would likely explore it and colonize it. That colony's population would grow until it stabilized to live sustainably around the same density as the pre-existing islands, that is the islands that are already there. Let's say we call the new island Mars. Just because Mars could support a new population doesn't mean the old islands could support more. They would still have to live sustainably or risk collapse no matter how many people Mars, the new island, could support. On the contrary, if the Hawaiians saw Mars as an escape, they might return to their practices when they traded with the Polynesians and lower the island's capacity to sustain life in society. In short, being able to colonize Mars doesn't enable people to live unsustainably back home, whether the hypothetical island or the planet. As it happens, I'm still quoting the book now, my manuscript here. As it happens, I support exploring other planets, but not for a small few to escape in the nick of time, leaving billions behind. One of my favorite scenes in the Star Wars franchise illustrates the current Mars strategy. It comes near the end of Return of the Jedi. Lando Calrissian in the Millennium Falcon has destroyed the generator at the core of the Death Star, which begins to explode from the core outward. They fly out as fast as they can, but the wall of flame is catching up. It engulfs a TIE fighter just behind them, which explodes. We see the front view where the wall of flame behind them grows bigger and bigger, closer and closer. Then the camera jumps to the side view, showing the wall approaching them, the machinery of the doomed Death Star whizzing by, meters from the ship. The view cuts to inside the Falcon. Pedal to the metal, they're pushing the ship to its limits. Can they go any faster? They know the flames blew up one ship behind them. Before them, they see the leading edge of the wall of flame overtaking them, encroaching their view from outside in. Tongues of flame are ahead of them. All they can do is go as fast as they can. The flames nearly engulf them. Suddenly, barely visible through the flame, the dark at the end of the tunnel, space. And in a moment, they skyrocket out. Lando yeehaws. The front view again. Behind the Falcon, the Death Star explodes behind them. Wow, an exciting movie scene. I imagine several Silicon Valley billionaires dreaming themselves Lando, letting out a rebel yell as they escape the planet they helped ruin. Again, I support exploring Mars, but not letting it motivate living unsustainably here, like the Hawaiians when trading with Polynesia. It would be easier to terraform Antarctica or a desert, but we can't, let alone under the sea, all of which would be incomparably easier than living on Mars. our best attempt at something close, Biosphere 2. It didn't work, and it was only in the Arizona desert. Could we make these things work? Possibly. In time to offer hope for us today? Not close. I see calm, steady research and development, the fastest, safest, most effective way to reach there. So that was this kind of set piece in my book, talking about that escaping in the nick of time. It's very exciting, but I don't think it's the best way to, I think it sends a message of, we can trash it here because we got this escape route, but I don't think that it doesn't work just because we could grow something on Mars. Say we could grow a colony there. That doesn't mean that we can stop living sustainably here. And if we believe that we can't live sustainably there, it's not long before we get the same problems there than here. And if we believe that we can live sustainably there, why not live sustainably here? We certainly think that we can live sustainably on the trajectory from Earth to Mars, which is probably years in the space, when people have to live sustainably, very sustainably, because they're in the rocket ship, a spaceship that doesn't have extra resources. They can have solar panels, but that's about it. I think a lot of people think, oh, good, we can relax here. We can live on, we don't have to worry about all that sustainability stuff because we got a way out. But I think that's a mistake.
Right. And I look at it also, just from listening to what you just read, is that we hear people all the time talking about, you know, how we've gone in, we've destroyed the forest, we've destroyed the rainforest and whatnot. Why would we want to, even if we could go to Mars or these other planets, why would we want to go there and overpopulate them, or to start knocking down things and creating, building colonies? And why wouldn't we just want it just to leave it as it is and enjoy it, being able to see it, you know, at night through a telescope and enjoy the planets, as opposed to us going there and overpopulating it? We don't know if there's some intelligent life that's there. There's probably some type of life. Why would we want to go there and mess it up? That curiosity that man has going into space. Yeah, I like the idea. I like the concept, seeing Star Trek, and it is fascinating. But why leave here to go there? What is the purpose?
I mean, that's a philosophical question that, to some extent, it's an individual question. If someone has the resources to do it and they really want to do it, in our culture, they can give it a shot. You can imagine people in Europe saying, why would someone send ships off, possibly off the edge of the world? Why do they really think that they can reach India by going the opposite direction? And turns out they found North America, and we're living on North America. Should they have left it? I'm not sure. And before that, the people who became the Native Americans, who came across the Bering Strait, they came to a continents filled with much more wildlife and diversity than was there by the time the Europeans arrived. So they flattened out everywhere the humans went, we knocked out the large animals, the mastodons and saber-toothed tigers. And apparently there were beavers the size of cars, 6 feet tall. So by the time the Europeans got there, they were all gone. That question of, can we go to places and appreciate them and honor them and keep them, steward them? We haven't been so good at that here. I mean, for most of human history, the Earth was so huge compared to the size of a person and the possible impact a person could have. It was really negligible. People couldn't, I mean, even when we invented plastic, if someone said, look at that plastic plate, and so, you know, it was like, oh, you can just throw these things away, no problem. And if someone said, well, but look at the Pacific, you might fill up the Pacific. I think up until very recently, I think people would say, are you kidding? Look at the size of this plastic plate and look at the size of the ocean. There's no chance that you could fill it up. And yet, you know, we have these big gyres that are growing bigger and bigger all the time and all sorts of other effects like that. Could we go to other places, and might we go to other places and wreck them? Is it possible we could go to other places and keep them pristine? If we believe that we can't help ourselves and we're going to wreck everywhere, maybe it's not such a great idea to get off this planet. If we believe that we can go to these places and not wreck places, then we should be able to not wreck here. Up until recently, people might push back and say, well, we're not wrecking here. Oh, it's overblown, these climate change predictions and things like that. Even when there were like rivers on fire in the 70s and when we had so much pollution that we, in some ways we've cleaned that up, but in some ways we've just moved it to other places. If we believe that we can not wreck things, can we make it so that here, the aquifers that were draining and Lake Mead is disappearing and Germany had those floods and all these things are happening. And it seems, there's still debate on it, but it seems pretty clear to me that there's been enough once every thousand year things that happened in back-to-back years or pretty soon after each other that we're changing the climate. If we believe that we're not going to wreck other places, can we live sustainably here? that's why I wrote the book. I mean, I think the answer is yes. I want to help get us there. I don't know if we're getting too far off the space at this point. I'll pause in case we did, but I can keep talking about this too.
No, I think that we're right on target, because that would be the next question that, you know, if we're going to outer space, and if we're going, there's pollution right there when they're going up in their rockets. I've looked at Jeff Bezos, I looked at Richard Branson. Everyone was happy about it. It's great, but there's a level of pollution that's taking place with the emissions from the rockets that we've all talked about. But just the idea and the concept that we're going and we will be able to see the tip of the earth. Wow, it'd be spectacular. I mean, look at when Jeff Bezos came back down. He was elated. He's like, wow, man, it was great. I would like to do it. I can see it on TV. I don't necessarily have to go there if I feel that me going there is going to cause more damage to the atmosphere. Don't know if anyone is thinking about that. Maybe they'll think about it after we've caused the damage. Who knows? But certainly, eventually, people will start going to outer space, because we've always wanted to go where no man has gone before, to seek out new life and civilizations, as Star Trek says. So it is interesting, it's exciting, but should we do it just because we can? Like you said, just because we can do it doesn't mean that we should do it.
Yeah. Speaking of civilizations, we look at the International Space Station, and that is still up and running. Josh, what are your thoughts on the International Space Station? Any information you can give us that the average person might not know? And are there any future plans for it to expand, maybe build another one? Would you like to see that?
I didn't work too much on the International Space Station. I think it's one of the very interesting things about it. And as an example of science transcends cultures. Sports is like that. The arts are like that. Science is one of the places where people from lots of different cultures can work together, because it's nature. So that was a place where Americans and Russians could work together. And I think that helped overcome differences between places. Another big case of something like that in a totally different area was there's birds that fly over Israel and Lebanon. And apparently I don't know this too well, but apparently it's a place where like a lot of birds fly between Europe and Africa, and they go over this one area. And at times when Lebanon and Israel were at odds and wouldn't talk to each other, the bird watchers did need to talk to each other. And it was kind of like ping pong diplomacy that helped open up American relationship with China, that everyone on both sides said, yeah, the bird people got to talk to each other, and that opened things up. So the International Space Station feels like something like that to me, of a place where the international was a big part of it. I think that in terms of science, so there's the engineering to it and the science to it. The science, I'm not aware of too much really groundbreaking science that came from it. I think of it more of as an engineering project and interesting, but I'm not sure what they're really getting out of it. I feel like I'm not aware of big results that we couldn't have gotten better and cheaper in terms of just doing research through things that are unmanned. On the other hand, people have been up there for long times. And so if we wanted to find out effects of low gravity on people, that's one of the ways to do it. I'm not sure how much they're doing with it now. I think it's pretty expensive. So it hasn't been something I've followed too much, because I don't think of it as a big science thing. I think of it as more as an engineering thing. And I think it's kind of, my gut feeling is that it's reached its limits. But then as an international thing, I think it's been very opening cross-border communications.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because as it looks very cool, and the footage from inside of it, you can even watch it live, I think, on YouTube. It's very cool to see everybody floating around inside of it. But I was wondering if it's even produced big results and how it would even do so. Kind of a fun question here, Josh, before we let you go. Rob asked me at the top of the show if I believed in the UFO sightings. You worked with NASA and around a lot of people that worked at NASA when you were there, I am sure. Do you personally believe in UFOs? And did you speak to very many people at NASA that were big believers?
Well, now technically UFO means unidentified flying object. Do I believe that there are objects that are up there that are unidentified? Yes. I think you probably meant, do I believe that these UFOs are from outer space? Are they alien creatures or alien technology? And I personally don't. Everyone has a recording device that's really great in the form of a cell phone that they carry with them all the time. And these things are, the ones that I've heard about seem to be predictable, and like the same people keep seeing the same things, and yet they don't have a high quality image of it. Despite having the best optics ever, it seems too much, the odds of it being noise or something, refraction or something like that, that seems much more likely. And so we can't throw it out. So when I was in graduate school, it was a little bit before graduate school, cold fusion came out. The idea that maybe if you passed a current through water, you could get nuclear reactions to happen. And everybody that I talked to, all the physicists that I talked to were like, it's not possible. But some of the grad students said, well, let's do it. And no one stopped them. No one would say, don't do it, because it is possible. So no scientist that I know of would just outright dismiss something possible. You know, it's possible. And until someone like sees what we call a UFO and goes up and finds out, oh, it's actually, and like can explain it without a shadow of a doubt what it actually is, and it's not a UFO, then we have to be open to it being a UFO. And we'd be very excited for the UFO to be an alien thing. But there's just no, I haven't seen anything that I find compelling.
Yeah, there's so many of us that just want to believe so bad. Josh, you have a podcast yourself. I know I've been on it. Rob's been on it. Where could people check that out?
Yeah, so it's called This Sustainable Life, and it's at joshuaspodek.com/podcast.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I recommend people go check out that show. And thank you for joining us tonight on another episode of After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud Radio Network. If you want to have a great product, if you're looking for better sleep, focus, and energy, check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator of nutritional supplements for cell health. Rob and I have been taking Healthy Cell. We both feel great. Our energy is better. Our brain power is better. You can call to action. Go to healthycell.com and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any products. And you find us on America Out Loud on iHeartRadio, Spotify, or Stitcher. Head on over to the website, AmericaOutLoud.com, for countless hours of content. Remember to stand for something or you will fall for nothing.